In 1967, we awoke. Awoke to the knowledge of the village. Now, 50 years on, we invite you, good citizens, to join us in celebrating the timeless topics, eloquent prose, and striking visuals of the iconic programme, The Prisoner.
Welcome to the Eternal Village Cast, a program of conversations with those who created, those who've contributed to the canon, and those who cherish the brilliant and influential program, The Prisoner. Attention, technical department. We are aware that the colony possesses a prisoner who would be very useful for our purposes. Acquire this individual and bring them into our eternal village. Good people, we are extremely honored to share a conversation with the esteemed computer gaming designer, consultant, and educator, Mr. David Mullich.
So, David, in our quest to find all the people that have contributed to this canon of amazing creativity about The Prisoner, you weave in at a very interesting time reference and a very interesting technology as far back as, if I understand, around 1980, when you decided to create a game all about The Prisoner. Am I correct in that?
You are correct.
Fascinating. Now, 1980, not what we would say is the era of massive computer gaming. These are more the type of games that people who are very comfortable with computers probably be the ones to engage. Is that true?
It was, because this was the era in which computers were first entering the home.
Yeah.
And so most people weren't familiar with computers and what they could do, and probably the first people to adopt home computers were more technologically savvy than your average person. It took a while before, a long while before the average person started getting computers into the home.
Yes. So now, back in the story of your path to learning, path to creativity, when you headed off into the big wide world, heading to school, what did you dream of being? What did you want to do in this great thing we call a life and a career? What was your aspiration?
Well, I knew it was something creative, and it was just a matter of where to focus my energies, because growing up, I would make my own board games, and I'd film my own Super 8 motion pictures, and I would draw drawings of Lord of the Rings and write Star Trek stories. So going into college, I couldn't really figure out whether I wanted to be a filmmaker, a writer, or an artist. And so when I went to pre-register for, I went to Cal State Northridge, mm-hmm. which had a very good radio, television, film department, and still does. I went to pre-register, but when I saw the line of students wrapped around the building, my practical side kicked in. And I said, there's no way all these people are going to get a job in the entertainment industry. Let's find something a little bit more practical for you. So I wound up taking a whole bunch of courses. And because I was a science fiction nerd, I really liked the ideas of computers and technology. So I took a computer science class just to fulfill my general education requirements. But one day, I was sitting in the computer lab just waiting to do my homework. And I was getting bored waiting to use the printer. So I started typing out a Star Trek game. Which is a game where you go and you just type in coordinates to move your Starship Enterprise around a grid, and then Klingons would appear and you'd type in other coordinates to fire photon torpedoes. But as I was creating it, I realized essentially what I was doing, I was setting up a story or a scenario for players. What players were really doing were creating their own story through their actions in this game. And whereas writers determine what characters are going to do in that story, it's really the players who determine what the choices are going to be in a video game. And that got me all excited about the idea of interactive entertainment.
Now, that is fascinating, because what I hear is a very eclectic mind. Because to set the stage for people who may be younger and not realize this, you've used the term video game in 1980, computer-based, when the reality is the computer games we were playing back then, arcade-based, very small capacitors, very simple, back in the era of things like Pong. And yet you somehow were visioning this idea that you could create something where the player was really driving the game, which video games we interacted with at a pizza parlor or something like that in those days, it was follow the mouse, follow what the game created. Yet you had the idea to create something that was user-driven.
Well, it helped that in my computer class, I was connected to a mini computer, a PDP-11, which was far more powerful than the processors available for doing video games at the time, which, you know, your Pongs and Odysseys and your arcade-based systems, which were all mostly very simple games, very simple rules, mostly action, in fact, almost completely action, dexterity-based games. But I was interested in storytelling. And with the computer, I had a very easy access to the full power of the computer and being able to have introduce the complexity of storytelling.
And again, back to the idea of context. When you were creating that Star Trek game, we should remind the listener that those quote-unquote ships that were moving on the screen, or those Klingons, that were actually probably more like triangles and squares, correct? The
Not
graphic.
Even that. They
Not
were,
even
text. It was what we called text graphics.
Yeah.
So the Enterprise was represented by a letter E, and the Klingons were by the letter K, and stars by an asterisk. It was all just placing text on the screen, because there were no graphics capabilities available.
No. So this takes, in your sense of both being creator but visioner, this takes the kind of mind who can take those extremely tangible symbols and fantasize them into a world where you're not only seeing the movement, but you're in your mind's eye seeing what that would look like.
Well, it takes some kind of mind to do it. I don't know how to categorize it, but my mind took those twists and turns.
Okay.
To be able to do that. So anyway, I made my major in computer science, but it wasn't until about a year later when, of all things, I was taking a business programming course. And this was a time when we were using punch cards.
Yes.
To program computers. My computer science professor noticed that I was using the computer to do things like generate poetry and print out pictures of the Starship Enterprise, because I still had my artistic writing bug with me. So he called me over to his office, and I thought I was going to get chewed out, but instead he offered me a job. He and a couple of the other professors at Cal State Northridge had opened up one of the very first home computer stores in Los Angeles. In fact, I think it was the second one ever to open. And they were selling the Apple II computer. And he asked me if I'd be interested in being a clerk in a store. So I jumped at the chance. The only other job I had previously was working at a Jack in the Box over the summer. So this was certainly a lot more appetizing than Jack in the Box food. And the store was right across the street from the college. So I started working there as a clerk, which among other things was not just helping out with they had a mail order business where they had a catalog for buying computers and computer accessories, but also software that included games.
Right.
And that's where I got first introduced to games that were computer games that were published by mom and pop shop game publishers.
Can you give us an idea of what some of those themes or topics were that were at the time a over-the-counter game? What were people playing?
There was a chess playing program called Sargon,
mm-hmm.
and there were text-based adventure games where, like the original adventure, the Colossal Cave Adventure and Zork,
mm-hmm.
that was all about typing in, go north, pick up the rock, look down the hole, just communicating with very simple words, and then it would bring back a text reply about what it is that you would see. So those were popular at the time, as well as some very simple versions of the arcade games. And in fact, a lot of our customers, they buy a home computer, because they were hobbyists. And at the time, home computers were very easy to program. They would come with a simple programming language called BASIC, Beginner's All-Purpose Symbolic Instruction Code. Anyone can learn and learn to program the computer. And a lot of our customers would program checkbook balancing applications and databases and even some simple games that bring to the store, and we publish for them. We sell them to our other customers or put them in our catalog. And a couple of our customers opened up some of the very first game publishers out there. And one of them was a gentleman by the name of Sherwin Steffen, mm-hmm. who had started up a company called Eduware Services for educational software. But also he published games. And he asked me if I'd be interested in writing some games for him to publish. Boy, would I said. And so in addition to working in the computer store as a clerk and doing my homework at college, I would make games on the side. And the very first game I made was a text-based adventure, role-playing game, that was actually a sequel to a game expansion to a game that Eduard already made called Space, which was a science fiction role-playing game. And he asked me to create an additional scenario for it. So I created a Space 2, where you could take characters that you created in space and then could take them on further adventures. And I was taking an anthropology class at the time. So I created a colonization game that had several different components to it. One was a farming a planet, cultivating the land, growing animals on it. The other was another scenario in it was being a shaman and trying to gain gatherers for your religion. And then a third one was called Psychedelia, which involved the use of psychedelic drugs. That was kind of a risk-benefit type of game. It could possibly increase your wisdom and intelligence, but also possibly cause you physical defects.
Right.
So it was an exploration of various topics. I was trying to get across some of the ideas that I learned in anthropology, as well as some of the risks and dangers of drug usage at the time. So I was always very interested in games that didn't just entertain, mm-hmm. but either had some kind of message associated with it or was metaphorical somehow.
Absolutely. Now, these games that would be additions to the other original program,
right?
They would be sold to people by some media, because, again, even though what you're describing to me sounds like what truly was the first wave of computer and the internet, this whole brand new economy, that wasn't able to be traded digitally. So you would create it, then how would people buy that new portion that you created? How would they get their hands on it?
Well, the first games we sold at Eduware, in fact, the first games were actually on audio tape. Because when you buy your computer, you'd also buy a cassette player to go with it. Mm-hmm. With two cables that would plug into the microphone and the speaker hooks in your outlets in your computer. And so when you wanted to load a game in from a cassette tape, you press play on the player and type in load in your computer, and the program was saved as sound. And so it would play beeps and boops across the wire, and that would translate it into digital data that would store in the computer's memory. And if you wanted to save a program you created, you press record on your player and type in save, and it would record out the sound that corresponded to the digital information on your computer. Mm. So that was the first wave of it. And I think the first games I made were indeed on cassette tape. But very soon after that, floppy disks became available.
Right.
And so these were kind of discs of Mylar encased in a kind of like a cardboard-like envelope to give it, make it a little bit sturdier. And it was like five and a quarter inches on a side that you would put into your drive. And that was certainly saving and loading stuff was a lot faster. And you did have to buy a disk drive to go with your computer, but a lot more convenient and held a lot more in storage than the audio tapes. So some of my first games were both on audio and on floppy disk.
The archivist in me has to ask the question, do you still have a few of those somewhere in your possessions?
I do. Not as many as I originally had. I think I was one of the rounds I was clearing out the garage. I think my wife convinced me that I didn't need a whole lot of some stuff anymore, and I threw some of it out, and I always regretted that because it was after that that people started archiving these things.
Yeah.
And so a couple of museums had asked me, you know, if I had old copies, and for some things I no longer had copies. Some things I do, but not everything, not as much as I used to.
Oh, how fascinating. So one other digression, which I have to ask, at what point, at which going home for Thanksgiving, did you say to your parents, I'd like a little praise for the excellent choice I made because I could have been over there with the film guys who now have no jobs? I mean, at what point did they realize you were brilliant and pick the right career path? Was it the second year of college, third?
Well, when they thought that they didn't say this to my face. This I found out later. It wasn't until I was about 30 that my stepmother said to me, that she and my father always were worried about me, that I had chosen a career that was kind of like for children and wouldn't amount to anything. But she had to admit she was wrong and was impressed with the success that I had earned in my career. So it took about 10 years.
That's okay. That's all right.
But they never discouraged me. They kind of kept it inside themselves. So they kind of revered the. Only once I was successful did they reveal their inner reservations.
Well, which I appreciated. The fact that you instantly, people saw your talent and your passion, and that created one opportunity, and even being in the marketplace created more. So I'm going to bet that college seemed to fly by because you're being that busy with both work and creative work.
It did. I really loved college, and I did well in it, and it was a great experience. Yeah, it did fly by. And I did like three games for Eduware, and when I graduated, they made me an offer to hire me full-time. Mm-hmm. And I took them up on it. It was my dad and stepmother and also my mother would probably a little bit even more concerned because Eduware was actually a four-person company operating out of the owner's apartment. And I was the fourth person. So it was myself and the owner, Sherwin Stephan, his partner, Steve Pedersen, and our salesperson, Mike Lieberman, all working out of this one apartment, making educational software and video games. And I was working at the company for about 6 months where I told them, there's a game I want to do. I'm just so passionate about it. I really have to do this. I've made the other games for you and they've done well, but I really want to make this game based upon the show, The Prisoner.
Now, what was their immediate response? Because in the fandom, or if you will, the fraternity of The Prisoner, we've all experienced so many times that you say to somebody, have you heard this show? Do you know about this program? And you get the kind of, I call it the Cocker Spaniel look, where people tilt their head and go, I don't know what you're talking about. In 1980, we're relatively close to when the show was aired in the U.S., and from reading on your wonderful website, you, like me, saw it on PBS, you know, around that time. Did the folks at the company have any idea what you were about to expose them to, or did they just think David's a creative genius, let him go?
They I think they had some awareness of the TV show. They weren't the fans that I was. The Prisoner was actually playing on PBS while I was in college beforehand. Mm-hmm. So this was after its PBS run. And actually, it was not my first exposure to the series. I'm old enough that I actually saw it on its initial run on, was it CBS?
CBS, yes.
Yeah, in the late 1960s.
Uh-huh.
And I saw it at that time, and I thought it was weird and wonderful. And I was really into spy shows like I Spy and the Man from U.N.C.L.E., and I kind of saw it as that, kind of in that vein at the time, as well as the science fiction elements, like the other science fiction shows I like to watch. Mm-hmm. But when I saw it again, when I was in college, it was really at the right time where its themes about being an individual and fighting against the system and resisting conformity really appealed to me. Because of course, you know, when you're a teenager and becoming an adult, you're trying to assert your own individualities. You're breaking away from mm-hmm. you know, being under the control of your parents. Yeah. And so I was absolutely captivated. I was a prisoner in the village myself while I was watching that show, but a willing one, because I was just the themes of it just totally captivated me.
Fascinating.
And I just kept thinking about the show. I know it instantly became my favorite show of all time, and I kept thinking about the show and revisiting it. And I was so obsessed with it that I needed an outlet for my obsession. And that's what this was. I needed an outlet, and that's why I was so adamant about making a video game based upon it. Now they did have some trust in me, yeah. because of my other games, but they weren't big fans of this show. Steve Peterson, who was the president of the company, Sherwin Stephan met Steve when they were both at UCLA. Sherwin worked actually in the radio television department there, but had been laid off. But while I was there, he met Steve Peterson, who was an economics student, who was working, who did a show on the UCLA radio program, radio station. And so there was a difference in age between them of 20 years. So I think Steve was a little more familiar and excited about the television show itself than I was. So what they did, they decided to do some explorations, and they had Mike Lieberman, our salesperson, call up a number of the stores that we sold to. Now at the time there was no GameStop, there was no Electronic Boutique,
no,
there was no Walmart or Toys R Us that purchase games. It was all over the country, a whole bunch of individual mom and pop game stores that we had approached individually to sell our games to. And so Mike would go up and call up and say, "Have you ever heard of The Prisoner?" And they go, "Oh, you mean Prisoner from Cell Block H?"
Mm-hmm.
It was another show that was airing at the time. Yeah. Completely different type of show.
Yeah.
And that's the one they had heard of. And the test marketing of the concept did not go well. No one had heard of it. No one was excited about it except for me. But I kept saying, "I have to do this. I have to do this. I have to do this." And I finally wore them down, and they said, "Okay, you can take some time out and make this game." So I did. I didn't have a plan for it ahead of time. I only knew one thing. I was very ignorant of copyright law at the time,
right?
And intellectual property rights. But I knew I didn't. It felt like a cheat to me to make a blatant ripoff of The Prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
So what I told them was, I want to make a game that was inspired by The Prisoner. So I want to make a game with the same themes, kind of the same scenario, but not call it The Prisoner. So in my game, instead of calling it The Village, I called the place they were trapped in The Island.
Right.
And instead of calling the person who seems to control the village number two, or in my case, the island, I call him the caretaker.
Mm.
And I just had the player referred to as a number sign without saying number six.
Okay.
So it was copyright violation. It was close enough that if anyone had noticed and bothered and cared, we would have gone into trouble. But in my naivety, I thought I was far enough away that wasn't harming anyone, especially the makers of the original Prisoner TV series. But my bosses at Edgeware insisted that the game be titled The Prisoner anyway and use the Prisoner font as the font for the game.
Which ultimately, in a broader discussion, is not owned by the copyright folks. That is simply a font that's out there. I think sometimes people get confused as to what is
true.
Controlled.
The font isn't.
Yeah, yeah.
But it might have been a trademark.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if it was or not. Yeah. You can sometimes use a word displayed in a particular font as a trademark.
Right.
Which is different from copyright. Copyright protects literary, artistic, and musical works, whereas yeah. trademark protects identifiers used in commerce.
Yeah.
So, but we didn't even check to see if we were making doing trademark infringement at the time. Regardless, we just proceeded ahead. And all I knew is I was obsessed with creating this game, and I had no plan for it ahead of time. Other than I wanted to be taking play, I wanted you to be a somebody who resigned from their job. And I don't think I was just like the show. I didn't make it clear that you were a secret agent. You resigned from your job, and then you're kidnapped and taken to this place called the island. And that I'd have 20 locations in the game that you could visit, and they were all exploring similar themes of not conforming and how society tries to make us conform in each of the different ones. And I just, without a plan, I just sat down and I typed on the keyboard and I designed as I programmed. And I spent six, which previously the longest I'd spent working on a game was 2 weeks. On this game, 6 weeks.
Six contiguous weeks,
which was an incredible amount of time for us at that period in game development history.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just worked on it, you know, day and night, just creating as I was programming, and I came up with this game that eventually turned out to be a huge good sales success for us. In fact, mm-hmm. I think it was one of our best-selling products at the time. We did very well selling educational software, but our game software did well. It was a smash critical hit for it being essentially interactive fiction.
And again, for the folks who I certainly hope will follow the click and take them to the YouTube that shows part of it, it's important that they understand that this was a time when people had to do a lot of this in their imagination. Yes, the graphics you created had people, or in this case, a point of view moving through, for lack of a better word, let's call it a map. But it's not in the world of what people see today with almost looking like a movie. You had to have the creativity in your mind's eye to fill in a lot of the gaps and spaces that your story was taking someone through. When you were creating the game over those 6 weeks, was it a process of designing a part, and I'm going to just use the term saving, then playing and going back and expanding? Was it something that you kept experimenting in, or was it literally you created only in your own mind's eye before it was finished?
I didn't even create in my mind. I created while I was programming it.
Got it.
And it was like Patrick McGoohan was whispering in my ear. And I was just typing. I probably shouldn't say that because I'm not sure what he would have thought of the game, but there was something driving me, and I just it was almost like the equivalent of sitting down, deciding to write a novel, and then just typing it straight out from beginning to end, without hardly any editing or certainly any without outlining ahead of time.
I think the person actually who might have been, because he lived in Los Angeles, who could have been your secret mentor was Ray Bradbury, because that's exactly the way he wrote his books. So you and Ray have a very similar creative flow.
Now, well, I don't have his talent, but we might have similar work processes, at least on this project.
Exactly. Now, was there a point, of course, there's always the challenge for every artist. You see in your mind's eye everything you want to create. Then the factors of time and economics come in and you have to stop at a certain point. And I think an artist's self-criticism is always over the things that they didn't put in. Were there other facets of this? Were there other chapters and parts that you knew you wanted to add, but those 6 weeks came to a conclusion?
No. Because I had set the scope of the game ahead of time. Okay. I said there would be 20 rooms in the game and there would be a different experience in each room and it would all lead to a conclusion. And actually I determined the one thing I did determine ahead of time is the conclusion.
Good.
And in addition, so as you said, the graphics weren't great. So each of the rooms were composed of what I referred to earlier as text graphics. Mm-hmm. So it might be in some cases, a top-down view of the room that was comprised out of letters and other symbols forming the walls and objects in the room. In other cases, it was a little bit more metaphorical approach to what you would see in the room. Mm-hmm. And there were different rooms. There was a schoolhouse that played kind of a Simon Says type game. The problem is, if you did what Simon says, you would eventually lose and lose that particular scenario. So it was a game about breaking the rules, not doing what you're told. And in fact, the success often involved taking the rules, turning them on their ear and doing something completely the opposite. But you wouldn't know when you could do that and when you couldn't. It would surprise you. And that's something you'd have to unravel for yourself. And always, whenever you lost a particular scenario, it would send you back to square one, which was your house. And you'd start the game when you play it in your house, just like number six's when he wakes up after being gassed and taking the island, he wakes up in his quarters there.
Yeah.
You started the game in that, and you would always be returned there. And it was a maze, always an invisible maze. So every time you started, you had to it was a randomly generated maze, and you always had to work your way out of the maze to eventually get to the outside world where you could go off on a new adventure. Now let's give an example of the, it was all about escaping by breaking the rules. And what it would tell you is to move through the maze, you had to press the up, down, left, right key. And that was instructions on the game. However, if you showed some creativity and initiative and exploration, you could figure out for yourself that you could immediately leave the maze each time by pressing the escape key on your computer. So literally, if you thought about escaping,
yes,
you could escape temporarily.
You are a wicked genius, David.
And in fact, there were a number of other times where I would try to trick the player. I remember one of my favorite episodes is a couple of them. Actually, there were two of them. There were some of the Chimes of Big Ben and Many Happy Returns, where the prisoner thought, number six, yes, thought he had escaped.
Yes, absolutely.
Only to be returned back.
Yes.
Only realized it was a trick. And so the way I simulated that is you're playing the game, and at some point, I have to go back. So when you start the game, when you start play the game for the first time, you're given what's called your reason for resigning is encoded in what's called your resignation code.
Mm-hmm. I saw that it says you have to remember that code.
Yeah, so you remember your code and never reveal it to anyone. So you're given a three-digit number they can never reveal, which means you can never type it in the game under any circumstance. You could never select an option that had that number in it. You were just never ever to associate yourself with that number. So let's say your number is 124. So never at a time could you type in the number 124, select 124. Well, at one point of the game, you're playing a game and suddenly the game would crash and it would say error code 124. And the game would appear to go into the operating system. Now, if you typed in, typically what you do, if your game crashes on the Apple II, you would type it, and it would give you the line code that error on. You type in the word list and type in that line number, and it would list that line number in the program so you can see where your error was. Well, in our, the game was actually tricking you and making you think you had crashed outside the game if you actually typed in list 1, 2, 3, 4. You'd lose the game because you revealed your code. You're never ever supposed to reveal it.
Right.
So here, just like the prison number 6 was tricked into thinking it was escaped, here you're tricked into thinking you had left the game by erroring out. So that was the type of thing that that the game was full of. Lots of trying to trick the player in any way possible.
Okay, there are chronological questions I really want to get to, but I have to jump ahead and ask this. When this game started to become marketed and popularized, the way you're describing this to me, and I am not a computer programmer, sounds massively challenging. But again, you're talking about an audience that was comfortable, knew these things. Did you, in an era of letter writing and people actually, did you hear back from the people that had bought the game and were using it? Were they both inspired or frustrated or challenged or enticed by what you'd done? Was there any communication back to you from your audience once this game?
There wasn't email at the time. There wasn't the internet at the time. There wasn't email. But there was snail mail, and I would get fan letters.
Right. So
from people that would play the game and tell me how much they loved it.
Did they? Okay.
They loved wandering in my mind and how trippy it was. Yeah, I got a lot of fan mail. But plus there were also game magazines out there.
Review, do
game reviews. And the game always got excellent reviews. And people would write articles about the game.
Yeah.
There was one magazine, probably the most prominent Apple II magazine at the time, called Soft Talk. And I was very, very pleased and humbled where in one article they talked about The Prisoner being the finest example of artificial intelligence seen inside or outside of games. Because a big part of The Prisoner was when you finally got to a point where you could visit the head of the island, it was my version of number 2, the caretaker, you'd go in and you would talk to him by typing in natural language text. Like you would type in things, where am I? What is the island? Why am I here? Why did you kidnap me? And it would respond back in English. And it was an attempt to create dialogue between you and a computer character.
Right.
And that was one thing I actually did decide upon ahead of time, that when you eventually did get to a point where you could meet the caretaker, I wanted to be a dialogue.
To be interactive. But, right.
Because remember the beginning of The Prisoner. Yeah. It always begins with that instruction. Where am I? The village. Who are you? Number 2. Who am I? Number 6. I'm not a number. I'm a free man. Ha ha ha. I tried to create dialogue similar to that, but it wasn't canned. You could type in whatever you want.
Sure.
And I wanted the responses to be in that same tone, that same level of both challenging you and trying to deceive you, to frustrate you through a lot of answers that were really questions back, non-answer questions. And that was one case where it seemed I was a very successful in doing that.
Let's go back to a little bit of chronology. When was the game originally released by that company here in the U.S.?
What it was 1980. I'm not sure the exact date.
No, 1980.
1980.
With again, the marketplace was different back then, but many of our listeners and many of the fans of The Prisoner, of course, are in the UK. Do you know if the game made it out of the US? Did it sell internationally?
I don't know if it did or not.
Okay.
We didn't have an international sales. There might have been. I'm sure that some people outside the United States got a hold of it and played it.
Sure.
But I'm not sure we actually sold into stores in Europe or elsewhere.
But with, as you said, with magazines and back in the day, people were still as diligent to share information as they do that.
Yes.
How long was the game marketed in that format on those floppy disks for that platform, the Apple II?
It was a pretty, it was actually a bestseller for several months afterwards. Softalk did maintain a bestseller list, and The Prisoner made it to the bestseller list for a couple of months, but it was sort of like a backlist seller for us for a couple of years until Eduware had me make a sequel to the game. Because at that time, after a couple of years, there were other home computers started to come out. The initial set of home computers was the Apple II, the Commodore 64, and the TRS-80. But around this time, Atari started coming out with its own home computer, the Atari 800, and IBM came out with the IBM PC, and there were a couple of Commodore 64 came out, and so the I had created for Eduware, in addition to being a game designer programmer, I eventually led all of Eduware's product development. And part of my task is I created all of its programming utilities, which are programming tools and programming routines used in all of our products that would allow us to make use of the computer's graphic capabilities very, very easily. So we brought in a number of additional programmers, and I eventually led them all. I designed some of the games and all the games and some of the educational products. Sherwin Stephan and some other people were brought in and designed some of the other educational products. But we got to a point where I would do the design work and then have the programmers actually implement it, and I'd give them the tools to use to make the programming a little bit easier for them. And they asked me to create a new version of the Prisoner called Prisoner 2 that didn't rely on text graphics but on the primitive color graphics that were available at the time. So made a new version of the game that came out, and that too was very well reviewed and was a good seller for us and sold for a couple more years.
Wow. So this
was altogether Prisoner sold like for around 4 years.
Yeah.
Pretty steadily.
Amazing. Now then we're at the mid to late 1980s. Again, thinking about the graphics that people saw in arcade games, even the graphics, personal reference, in 1987, I worked for that little company over here in Kirkland called Nintendo. And of course, at that point was...
I've heard of it.
I think a few people did. Funny enough, the kids, would call every day. It seemed like they liked it. So the world of computer graphics and the visuals that an artist like you, a creator, could work with just kept exponentially getting more powerful, getting more expanded. Was there any point in that process where you thought, I really want to take this to that level, to the game cartridge, to the actual, I guess at the time, 6-bit, 8-bit type of computing? Was that a possibility?
Well, the computers got more and more powerful, and over time whatever games I was developing, I'd be developing for whatever was the common platform at the time. And actually, it was around 1984 that Eduware was bought out by an accounting software company called Peachtree Software that did accounting software for businesses, and they wanted to break into the home market. And they thought the best way to do that was to buy a company like ours that was already in the home. And so we were bought out, which put some money in my pocket, but they took over management of the company and did all of our marketing. And unfortunately, they marketed all of our products in the same packaging that they sold their accounting software in. So here was the Prisoner being put in packaging that was very similar to their accounting software packaging. And the fact that you put it on a shelf next to it, you couldn't tell the difference between the two.
Right.
And needless to say, within a year, our sales had gone to nothing and Eduware was driven out of business. So a couple of us Eduware employees went to start our own company. And we actually wanted to, we were interested in education combined with entertainment. So we wanted to create simulations, which were the very first serious games that were out there. Serious games are games that are played for more than just entertainment purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, as computers got a little bit more powerful, we wanted to advance our use of graphics. And by that time, we advanced beyond text graphics, beyond primitive 2D graphics, beyond more higher resolution 2D graphics. We were getting into doing 3D graphics at the time. So we made a couple of 3D simulations. One was a wilderness survival simulation, and the other was a lunar landing simulation that also taught you a lot about space exploration science. And so we formed our own company called Electric Transit. And we, unfortunately, back then, it was really tough to get distribution because, again, it was all these mom and pop stores all over the country. And so in order to sell our games, we had to go to a heavy hitter that already had distribution. And so you mentioned Nintendo as being a little company that maybe people heard about. The company that we went to sell our game was a little startup called Electronic Arts that actually formed maybe a couple years before we did. But they were already a big success and had a lot of big distribution, and we became their first affiliated label publisher, the first game company outside Electronic Arts whose games that they distributed.
And for most of the young, folks, they would not understand that because all they would know is EA Games. Because
yes,
right, like HBO. When I was a child, it was called Home Box Office. Now they only know it as HBO. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. So we were working with EA a couple of years after EA was founded.
Fascinating.
And so we were. They unfortunately, they also made all their first mistakes on us.
And, okay. Okay.
By they overestimated the amount of games that they ordered, and we therefore. That they could sell, which caused us to over manufacture, which caused us to produce more games than they could sell, and they kind of pressured us into buying back inventory, and we got into a financial hole we could never get out of.
Yes.
So unfortunately, our company went out of business 2 years later. So figuring out what I was going to do next, because all the money I had made off of selling Edgeware had gone into Electric Transit, so my savings were almost gone as a result. When a former programmer who worked for me at Edgeware contacted me and said he saw a want ad that I might be interested in, and it was for the Walt Disney Company, asking they were looking for software development specialists. That was the name of the position, to help them make video games. And so I was a huge Disney fan, among other things. We practically lived at Disneyland. My family would go there so often. And so I applied for the position, and they brought me in for an interview, and they asked me if I could name all seven dwarves, and I could name them off the top of my head, and they said, "You're hired." It actually pretty much went like that. And they hired me. And my first day of working for them was happened to be Snow White's 50th anniversary.
Ever since Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs premiered 50 years ago in 1937, one question has stuck in the minds of moviegoers.
What is it?
The question is, what are the names of the Seven Dwarfs?
Sleepy, Happy, Grumpy. Sleepy, Happy, Grumpy, Dopey, Sneezy, Bashful, Dot.
And what is after Sleepy?
Sneezy!
Sleepy, Happy, Grumpy, Dopey, Sneezy, Bashful, Dot.
I can't really do it very good.
Walt Disney's classic, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Disney had set up all the radio stations across the country to, at 7 a.m., play simultaneously, "Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go." So here I am driving to work on my first day, which happened to be Snow White's 50th anniversary. I'm listening to the radio, and suddenly over the radio it's playing, "Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go." So that was really trippy. And so I started working for the Walt Disney Company, and that's when I worked on my first console game for the Nintendo.
And to me, That almost sounds village-esque. Here you're going to an idyllic place, a land of dreams. You're arriving on your first day, which happens to be a monumental occasion. There's piped-in music, and you got there by knowing a seven-digit code. Are you sure, David, that you're not actually in the village? Are you sure?
You know what? I'm not sure I've ever escaped the village at times. I could very well be. This could all be an elaborate ruse to figure out why I did something in my past. So
I really think there's some signs here you're missing, David. I really do. I really do.
It could be. It could be.
Amazing. And again, 10 years on, and really the dream you had when you stood in that registration line was to make stories. And I think
it was, and to work with television properties, home television properties. And here I was working at a movie studio, working with movie and television properties, but I was taking those properties and making them interactive, which I would never guess such a thing was even possible at the time.
Yeah.
But here I was being blessed with that kind of opportunity.
Now, after describing all of that amazing history, and again, the term groundbreaking is not even enough, because you really were creating something out of only your own creativity. Thank you for that. Was there a point?
Well, just my own creativity, because credit has to be given to Patrick McGowan and the Prisoner of Television series. It was their inspiration, and you know, it was mine was an adaptation of their work.
Agree. So that's why we say people. Yep, that's why we say people who've added to the canon. You definitely added to the canon. What I'm curious about is, in these short intervening years, as your career grew, and we're going to point all of the audience to go to your fantastic website, the list of games and products and companies that you have nurtured and helped, and now as a consultant help, is amazing. But I have to know this. Are there moments, are there times when you have that free moment, maybe in an airplane, maybe at home, where you want to go back and now take all of the contemporary state-of-the-art technology and create a new version of this game using everything that's out there, but leveraging the same fundamental concepts you described, the idea of elusive logic or turning it on the player, the idea of using hidden codes? Is that a dream, anything you might want to bring to fruition?
Not only would I like to, I almost had an opportunity to. And you'll obviously know that there was a remake of The Prisoner made about, how long ago was it, like 5, 6, 8 years ago?
2009, yeah.
2009, all right. So almost 10 years ago with Jim Caviezel and Ian McKellen.
Yep.
All right, so I had heard about this remake being made, and I was really interested in it. For a couple of reasons, not only because of my attachments to The Prisoner, but all right, how's this for a coincidence? My wife is a high school teacher, and she worked with Jim Caviezel's wife. She was a teacher at that same high school, and I actually met her at a school function, and she told me about her husband, and he hadn't been, he had only been, the biggest thing he'd been in at the time was Full Metal Jacket. So she told me a little bit about his career, but I'd followed him since then. So I by proxy, I was 2 degrees of separation from Jim Caviezel.
Mm-hmm.
I had also communicated directly with Ian McKellen before, because another one of my obsessions is The Lord of the Rings. And during the making of Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings films, I was a news reporter for the OneRing.com, which was the one of the most popular Tolkien sites. And so as news reporter, I happened to get in contact with Ian McKellen and ask him a couple of things about his interpretations of Gandalf. So I was 1 degree of separation from Ian McKellen. So in addition to being a fan of The Prisoner, I had this kind of association with both Jim Caviezel and Ian McKellen. So I was really interested in that project, and I followed its development. And out of the blue, the marketing company that was doing promotional work for this miniseries contacted me and asked me if I'd be interested in doing a version of The Prisoner for them. Mm-hmm. Kind of a free-to-play version. And I said, yes, I certainly would. And they said, well, all right, well, let's talk about this. And then we had some couple conversations after that. And then, unfortunately, I don't know what happened. The conversations didn't go anyplace. It kind of died out. So nothing ever came of it, for which I'm kind of glad, because I was very dissatisfied with how the miniseries turned out. So as much as I would have liked to have opportunity to do a remake of The Prisoner,
yeah,
then would not have been the time.
Okay. So I know that people are looking at their phones or MP3 players or computers and screaming, then is now possibly the time?
If someone will pay me for it.
Got it.
Unfortunately,
okay.
I this is my career.
Yeah.
And I just don't have the time. Most of my volunteer work, the stuff I do on the side, is in terms of education. I do a lot of work with the Boy Scouts, teaching Boy Scouts about game design. I do a lot of pro bono work with helping kids with game design. And unfortunately, I don't have the energy or the time or for doing game development for free. I would love for someone to pay me to do a new version of The Prisoner. Because to do that right, I'd have to put together a team, because making games that are of the quality level the games are now, it takes a variety of specialists.
It does.
So I'd have to put together a team, and it's tough to do a team where they're not getting paid. So yeah, I'd love to do a Prisoner again if I could get such a game funded.
Well, David, I wish the world would give you that offer, but I also wish that maybe you might get trapped in the island and the caretaker would give you an assignment with all sorts of resources, because if it isn't in this world, maybe it can be another world that we can join you again in playing a Prisoner computer game.
Countdown has now started. As I was saying, the countdown has now already started.
Indeed. The countdown to this year's Eternal Village event is underway. We encourage all villagers to take advantage of the special registration prices and offers available only through June 30th. Please visit theeternalvillage.org for full details.
Now, David, you discovered The Prisoner at an extremely early age during its very first run. And then, as you've told us, you rediscovered it again. Tell us why, now so many years on, why is this show still in your pantheon of favorite things?
I think it's because it was a thinking person show. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a simple action-adventure series. It explored the concepts of individuality and to what degree does one need to resist how society forces us to conform in a number of different ways. And really, what does it mean to be an individual, and to what extent can you believe what it is that you're being told by society and asked to do by society? Mm-hmm. I think it's sort of a questioning of society as a whole that is the sort of thing that really wasn't in a lot of other television shows. There's certainly were television shows that were morality plays. Certainly a lot of episodes of Star Trek were morality plays, so there were messages with themes, but not this level of exploration of very, very abstract concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And The Prisoner did so sometimes with greater success than other times, but the very fact that it was indeed so metaphorical in the stories that it told and in the issues it probed, just made it something that you can go back and analyze over and over again. And it's just exciting stuff to talk about because it never ceases to be relevant.
Yeah.
I mean, even today, you look at our role with government and our government's role with us, and, you know, on the internet, where you think that it's a world of where you're exploring ideas and everyone has a voice, a lot of those voices are forcing us to conform. And if we express thoughts and opinions that are outside the majority point of view, we are trolled, we are trashed, yeah. We are doxxed. As a group, as an informal group, is sort of like a hive mind. It comes together and it's like the village that's forcing people to conform and tortures them, emotionally tortures them, when they don't conform.
Well,
so it's, yeah, but the themes are even more relevant today than they were in the 1960s.
Agree. And I would say the only counter I might say is it's not oftentimes the majority. It's the fact that now the technology we've created has leveled the playing field where everyone has access to a soundboard, meaning the internet. And what sometimes seems to be the case is that a very small clique of people in the village are going after an opinion they don't like. It's not so much the majority. It's the very vocal minority sometimes, as you've said, that really doesn't allow certain things to be even shared, expressed, because they find it against their thought.
You're absolutely right about that. That's true. There can be a very vocal minority that has somehow either by gaining political power or by using internet terrorist methods to get their way.
Right.
And forcing people. So there are people with a minority viewpoint that do everything in their power to get people to conform to that minority viewpoint. So you think we have this wonderful tool with us that would encourage individuality and all sorts of different types of thinking and ideas and individualism. It's actually often does the opposite. So the themes of The Prisoner are just as relevant now as they were then. So I think that's one reason why, at least for me, at least, it is a show that has never left me and probably will never leave me.
So on that, let me ask, when you originally saw the show, of course, a child, and it was on the TV for one summer, it was gone. Then later, like so many of us around the same age, thank goodness PBS, at least in the US, showed those episodes again. But that was around the time of, let's say, the turn of 1980, when the concept and the idea of home video was still one of those upper echelon. You had to be really rich to get it. When was the first time that you actually were able to possess these shows that you cherish so much, to be able to really digest and watch them again and again?
It's thanks to Blockbuster. I would go and rent it on VHS tape.
Yeah.
Rent the entire series. And that's where I would see them. And then later on DVD.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it on streaming. I haven't actually looked for it.
No, it has. ITV has held that and a lot of their catalog, not just The Prisoner. For some reason, they are not adopting that model very well. So it's not out there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's unfortunate because now after talking to you, Carl, I now have a hunger to dive into the show again and go through all 17 episodes.
That's fantastic. Is there in memory a favorite episode that you would go back and let's say it would be your comfort episode to watch again and again?
I think it's The Chimes of Big Ben.
Got it.
Is my favorite episode.
The concept.
I really like that one.
The potential escape, but the actual twist.
Yes. I think that's my favorite episode.
That's awesome. Well, David, we absolutely appreciate you sharing your thoughts about it. And we hope that now you realize there's an entire community out here and we want you to be a part of it. So we will link everyone to all of your media and all your sites, and hopefully you will link back so that this conversation doesn't have to happen in absentia. You can be part of our conversation where we don't dox anybody. I promise that doesn't happen.
Oh, very good. Well, despite my inclinations to remain an individual, I think this would be a community I'd happily be a participant of.
All villagers are encouraged to share their thoughts and contributions with the Eternal Village Cast. Please send your remarks care of info@theeternalvillage.org. Until our next program, be seeing you.